government has called on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to testify before a US investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Documents and images released in the US on Friday have raised further questions about the links between them. The former prince has always strongly denied all allegations of any wrongdoing connected to the disgraced financier. The community's secretary, Steve Reed, said he should give evidence to the US Congress.
Anybody, not just Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, anybody that has insight or information to share that can shine a light on what has gone wrong so that we can get some justice for the women who have suffered so much, then they should come forward and testify.
Separately, a second woman has alleged that she was sent to the UK by Epstein to have sex with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Her lawyer says he was communicating with the former prince's legal team, but that ceased after he was stripped of his titles last year. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has been contacted for comment. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said a new round of peace talks with Russia and the United States will be held in Abu Dhabi on Wednesday and Thursday. He said Ukraine was ready for a substantive discussion. President Trump has said Iran is talking seriously to his administration about a deal to prevent Tehran from developing nuclear weapons. The negotiations started after Mr. Trump threatened to attack Iran and deployed military forces nearby. The Iranian regime has warned that any such attack would lead to a regional war. Manufacturers of alcoholic drinks say they'll have to increase prices because they can't absorb a rise in alcohol duty, which is coming to force today. The levy went up by 3.66%. The Treasury says the duty helps fund the services people rely on. Israel says the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt will reopen for Palestinians tomorrow. It's been largely shut since May 2024. Israel says it'll allow limited movement of people, but no aid convoys. Before the war, Rafah was the only direct exit point for people in Gaza to reach the outside world, as well as a key entry point for aid. Separately, Israel says it'll ban the medical charity MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, from working in Gaza. MSF has refused to hand over a list of its staff in the territory. And the weather, a cloudy afternoon with outbreaks of rain for much of the UK. BBC News at 12:02. Now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The botanist, Dr. Sandra Knapp, is a senior researcher at the Natural History Museum. But that title hardly conveys the sheer adventure of her work. She's a kind of Indiana Jones of the plant world, travelling to remote regions of Central and Southern America and beyond. Her speciality is the Solanum genus, which includes potatoes, tomatoes and aubergines, and she's found and named more than 100 new varieties. The rainforests, where she's worked for more than 40 years, are a long way from the dry rural deserts of New Mexico, where she was born. Sandy, you've brought us music from Brahms, Mozart, even some contemporary music inspired by the biodata of your beloved plants. But I think we're going to begin with a Beethoven quartet.
Yes, when I was a child, I played the viola and I was in lots and lots of different orchestras and I've always loved music. And one of the things that I love about this particular Beethoven string quartet and about the Orion quartet who are playing this is that the violist in this is Steve Tenenbaum. And he used to come and play at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival when my parents lived in Santa Fe. And he and his wife, Ida Kafavian, lived in the cottage that was next door to my parents' house. And I think one of the things that's wonderful about the Orion string quartet is one often thinks about the viola as being that thing that you never hear. It's kind of in the background. It's there to make up the tonality. But Stephen really makes the viola sing in these Beethoven quartets.
Because sometimes viola parts can be rather boring, can't they?
Exactly.
And so having an interesting part makes all the difference, or at least being able to invest it with a zest for life.
And I think Beethoven wrote very good viola parts, but Stephen also invests those parts with a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm and passion.
Thank you. The first movement, Maestoso Allegro of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 12 in E-flat major, played by the Orion String Quartet. Did that have the Maestoso feeling with which it's marked?
I think absolutely. I love that. I love the way that opens and the way there's a pause in the middle and you're suddenly surprised when it starts again. And it's just, it's sort of Beethoven at his best, his string quartets. And that's my favourite one of them all.
Sandy Knapp, you grew up in Los Alamos in New Mexico. And what sort of childhood was it? Did you roam about the desert?
Well, Los Alamos is at about 2,000 metres, so it's 7,000 feet, so it's in the mountains. And yes, we did. We roamed around in the canyons. We used to pretend and do sort of cooking of things we called stimmy mush in the canyons. It was a marvellous, marvellous childhood. At the time that I was growing up, Los Alamos was a one-industry town. It was basically the Los Alamos National Laboratory. So you never said, what do your parents do? It's what division do your parents work in? And it was usually your father because there were lots and lots of nepotism rules. So we were taught in school by the most extraordinary set of women, many of whom had PhDs and were, you know, academics in their own right, but were unable to work in Los Alamos because of the nepotism rules in the laboratory. So they came and taught high school. It was extraordinary. So the education was phenomenal.
Your father was a physicist.
Yes, he was.
And your mother a mathematician by training. So was there a spirit of invention and discovery at home?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. We spend a lot of time outdoors and we also spend a lot of time going places and finding things and doing new things. My parents very much let us think for ourselves or encouraged us to think for ourselves and encouraged us to discover things for ourselves. And that was really important. I hugely miss my father, who was a physicist, with whom I discussed many things about how you do science, what's the right way to do science, how do we think about science. We used to have the craziest family arguments, which were physics is the only true science. And then my brother would say, no, mathematics is the only true science. And I'd go, well, botany's pretty good too. So I was the one who was the odd one out and did botany instead of mathematics or physics.
And of course, the work that was done at Los Alamos on developing the first atomic bomb would give rise to considerable debate.
That did. My father went to Los Alamos after the Manhattan Project. So he went in 1958. Mm. So after the Manhattan Projects. But the first house where I began to grow up in Los Alamos was one of the duplexes, which was built as part of the Manhattan Project.
Now, you said that you played the viola from an early age.
Yes. Well, not super early, but, you know, grade school.
But I do think there's something wonderful about at that age being part of a group, fitting in. And as you say, the viola's in the middle of the string texture, isn't it? So you've really got to be very aware of what's happening around you, which is a good training.
It is very good training. And I think the musical training that we had as part of that school system, I mean, everyone had lessons. And there was a very good Los Alamos Philharmonic Orchestra. It's a tiny town, but we had enough people who played instruments to have an orchestra. And I think it was having that as part of your school day also was orchestra. So it wasn't just after school. Music was part of schooling as well. And I was in the New Mexico State Youth Orchestra, which is terribly exciting because you got to go to interesting places with all your friends and play fun music. And that was great.
Handel's Messiah next. But I think you've chosen a very particular section. Why this?
This was part of my childhood every single Christmas, is the Los Alamos Orchestra and the Los Alamos Choir would do the Messiah, and we would play in the orchestra. So I was the first chair viola in the high school orchestra, so we would be part of the Philharmonic Orchestra playing. And like all teenagers, we were just fantastically frightful. I mean, we were awful. And this piece I've chosen is All We Like Sheep Have Gone Astray, and we would sing, Oh, We Like Sheep, and just giggle endlessly. So you can imagine teenagers in an orchestra trying really hard to suppress their giggles while this was going on.
Thank you.
You can just imagine a bunch of teenagers trying hard not to giggle.
Well, I know several conductors who have had to deal with, when we get to that point, a combination of people giggling and also going, "Mah!" Handel's Messiah and From It, As We Like Sheep Have Gone Astray, performed by the Rias Chamber Choir and the Academy for Ancient Music, conducted by Justin Doyle. Los Alamos is about 40 miles from the Santa Fe Opera House, Sandy, isn't it? So was that family entertainment available to you?
The Santa Fe Opera was very much a part of my growing up, and I was trying to remember when I went to my first opera, and I must have been 6 or 7, and it was Cinderella. So the Santa Fe Opera has always been a really interesting place for opera, partly because it's in a beautiful part of the world. So lots of very, very good opera singers want to come and spend the summer in Santa Fe. So we were uniquely lucky. It was also very exciting for us growing up because the opera didn't start until 9 o'clock at night because it was outdoors. So when I first started going to the opera, there were only a few seats which were covered and the rest was all open. So if it rained, everybody put out their ponchos and just put on their ponchos. No umbrellas were allowed because that impedes everybody else's view. So you put on your poncho and sat in the rain and listened to the opera. But when I was a child, and still today, the backdrop of all of the operas are the mountains of Los Alamos across the way, across the valley. So because it's at night and there are often lightning storms at night, you would have the backdrop of the opera would be the mountains themselves, plus sometimes exciting thunder and lightning and sort of nature at its most amazing. So what did you need a backdrop for when you had that? So it was very much a part of my growing up. And one of the things I did when I was a teenager, sort of in high school, is I ushered at the opera. And we wore sort of black outfits and turquoise jewelry and looked the part. But it was a really amazing training for how to get people to do something without telling them no. So you know, you'd say, "Please, sir, could you finish your drink before you come back into the theatre?" Or, you know, so it was real training about about crowd control. And it was fantastic. So I can remember standing in the back and listening to extraordinary world premieres, US premieres. We were so fortunate.
So you went really from singing about sheep to being a sheep dog.
Sort of. But I suppose the next piece I've chosen is an opera. And it's something I have hardly listened to since, but it's something that always has stuck in my mind. Because when I was 11, I went to the US premiere of Paul Hindemith's opera Cardillac, which is about a goldsmith and an alchemist, and it's got this great story.
17th century Paris.
Yes, 17th century Paris. Crazy stuff happens in that opera. But I went home, you know, at midnight, as you do, after the opera in Santa Fe, and went to sleep. I was 11. Woke up the next morning and my mother said, "The opera house has burnt down." And I said, "What?" And it had completely burnt down that night. And all that was left was the two staircases.
Not a very good omen for a new opera.
No.
So what are we going to hear from it?
Duet for two flutes. So not the opera singing.
Yes, it's from the Act One pantomime. Thank you. Although the subsequent events rather dominated your memory of that day, can you recall the music at all? Can you remember enjoying it?
I can remember enjoying it, and one of the things I love about opera is that it's not just the music, it's the combination of the music and the costumes and the acting. And so I sort of vaguely remember the costumes, and I remember them being grey and sort of raggedy and people having beards and, you know, but I was 11.
That was the Act One pantomime, a duet for two flutes, from Paul Hindemith's opera Cardiac, played by the WDR Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Josef Kalbert. You headed off, Sandy, to university in Claremont, California, to study marine biology. But what happened when you got there?
Well, the place where I went to university in the US was a liberal arts college. So you never went to study anything. You basically went and got a rounded education. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do because I played the viola and was interested in music. I was very interested in languages and had won French prizes and various other things. And every art student had to take a science class, and every science student has to take at least one arts class. So I thought, well, I'll take marine biology, because wouldn't that be great? Growing up in New Mexico, you don't get a lot of time at the ocean. We have no coastline. But marine biology was full. So I thought, okay, what can I do that will be so that I can be outdoors? And field botany was the class that I signed up for, and it was absolutely a revelation. Mm-hmm. And I never ever looked back.
How soon did you begin to find the actual area you wanted to specialise in?
Well, this is a class I took in my first year. The botany class was a class I took in my first year there. And it was wonderful. We went out in the desert every weekend and we looked at plants through microscopes, and I discovered a world that I had been all around me growing up in Los Alamos, plants and the outdoors, but I'd never looked at it in that particular way. And if you really think about it analytically, the skill set for doing the kind of science that I do, which is taxonomy, which is describing things and writing descriptions and looking at relationships, it's very similar to the skill set for languages, because you just have to remember a lot of stuff.
The rainforests are renowned for their extraordinary diversity, but I wonder whether this training taught you that there are things to discover closer to home if you look closely enough.
There are things to discover so close to home. I'm still completely surprised by the amazing plants that grow up between the train tracks in stations throughout Britain whenever I travel by train. And people always ask me, what's it like to discover to find a new species? Because you're not really discovering, because it's been there all along, right? Yeah. But for me, if I haven't seen something before, for me, it's a revelation. Sometimes it's exciting to see something in a situation where you've never seen it before, or see something that you've known about in a book but have never seen in life before. I mean, that one of the really exciting things that happened to me on this trip to Brazil, we went to a forest reserve near Manaus specifically to collect a particular tree, which is called Duquiodendron. One species in its genus, it's an iconic Brazilian thing. It's a 25 to 30 meter tree. It's not really a very good tree. And I've always wanted to see this plant. And it was so exciting to actually see it in the forest doing its thing.
What makes a tree a good tree as opposed to a bad tree?
I don't know. Well, you know, some trees kind of go straight into the ground, and they're quite hard wood. And some trees have buttresses which stabilize them when they get really tall. So some of these tropical trees have fabulous buttresses. Duquiodendron looks like it's trying to have buttresses, but not really. And it has quite soft wood. One of my colleagues I was with said, well, it's a tree that just hasn't quite made it as a tree.
Mozart next.
The Marriage of Figaro was my father's favourite opera. So every time I hear anything from The Marriage of Figaro, I think of my father, who actually, he died of pancreatic cancer in 2009. And interestingly enough, Steve Tenenbaum and his wife, Ida, came and played at the memorial service for my father. And it was his absolute favourite opera. And now, for me, it's that go-to piece of music when I need to do a very intense piece of work on the computer. And I know if I start at the beginning of The Marriage of Figaro and I get to the end, that I've been sitting at my computer too long.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear the duet between the Countess and Susanna.
Thank you.
One thing I love about Mozart operas is one thinks of that time that women didn't have a lot of agency. But in Mozart's operas, women have a lot of agency.
Absolutely true. We heard Sull'aria, the duet from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, sung by Kathleen Battle and Margaret Price, with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Riccardo Muti. Now, for your PhD, you focused on the plant genus Solanum. What kind of plants are these, and what drew them to you?
Well, again, it was kind of an accident that I ended up working on Solanum. It was what my major professor was working on, and I was his very first PhD student, so we were very much the same age. And he said, oh, you should work on Solanum sandi. I thought, I don't want to work on the same thing as you're working on. How ridiculous. What a stupid thing to do. And then he also convinced me to go to the tropics for the first time. And in the tropics, I found these amazing plants, which didn't have names. They were hanging out in the forest understory, doing heaven knows what. They were beautiful. And I thought, man, yeah, I could work on these. This would be fantastic. And I sort of fell into working on Solanum, and I still work on Solanum. It's one of the largest genera of flowering plants. There are only a handful of genera, 10 or 15, which have more than 1,000 species in them, and Solanum is one of those. And I suppose my journey in studying Solanum is, why are there so many species?
And have you found an answer to that question?
Well, kind of. I mean, I think I'm homing in on that answer, partly by understanding what the species are, but it's partly about dividing up the world according to body shape. So we don't think about plants as having bodies, but they do, just like animals. And solanums have all kinds of different body shapes. There are trees, there are tiny herbs, there are prickly things like aubergines, there are things that look like tomatoes, there are potatoes which have underground tubers. There's a huge plethora of different body shapes in solanum. And I think part of their success is dividing up the world according to body shape.
And isn't the deadly nightshade even related?
The deadly nightshade is in the same family. It's a different genus, which is called Atropa, Atropa belladonna. And there's a solanum which grows here in the UK and is native, well, possibly native here in the UK, which is called Solanum nigrum, the black nightshade. And everyone thinks it's poisonous, but actually you can eat the berries when they're ripe. Don't eat them when they're not ripe. They taste frightful and will make you sick. But when they're ripe, they're the basis of a jam industry in South Africa.
You took a year off to go to Panama, didn't you? Was that at the instigation of your professor or just your curiosity?
No, it was my curiosity. I found that the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis hired young botanists to basically go and collect plants in Panama. And so I applied for this job and I got it. And they gave me a trailer to live in, a kind of one of those mobile homes to live in, which was slightly falling apart. I fell through the bathroom floor once. They gave me a pickup truck to drive and told me to go collect plants. And that's what I did.
It sounds like a wonderfully adventurous thing to do.
It was fabulous. It was absolutely fantastic. That's where I learned to speak Spanish. It's where I learned patience, you know, with crazy things happened when I was in Panama. You know, sometimes the car breaks down and you have to hitchhike and it was really wonderful. It was really, really wonderful.
And did you find some extraordinary things?
Oh, I found great things. I found wonderful. I can still remember places and plants. I suppose I have a very visual memory. And so I can remember what it was like when I collected this particular orchid or this particular tree. And I found some things that I'd never seen before, which is pretty exciting. I found things that were new to science, which is also exciting, and had fun doing it.
So Panamanian music next.
Yes. So the folk music of Latin America is extraordinary. It's incredibly varied. I mean, you can think of tangos from Argentina and things from Mexico. But Panamanian folk music is very much influenced by Europeans because they brought the accordion with them, of course. And with a friend of mine, Lissy Coley, who subsequently went to work at the University of Utah, we used to climb over the fence. I was there in 1981, which was the first year that the canal was given back to the Panamanians from the Americans. So we used to climb over the fence and go dancing in downtown Panama City to music like this. Thank you.
Llevo una pena en el alma, pena que me hace sufrir.
Cuando yo siento que tú no me quieres, mejor no quiero vivir.
En tus ojitos yo miro que tú me quieres a mí.
Cuando yo siento que tú no me quieres, mejor no quiero vivir.
Son los celos de amor, son los celos de amor que me hacen sufrir y no me dejan vivir. Son los celos de amor, son los celos de amor que me hacen sufrir, no me dejan vivir.
Riot, isn't it?
It's an absolute riot. And these are traditional songs. So these are traditional songs from the Pacific coast of Panama. And the traditional dances that go with them have swirling, huge white skirts. And they're just amazing to watch.
Celos, which means jealousy, by Ian Carrizo, who also played the accordion. Not a million miles from Piazzolla and the bandolion.
No,
part of the world you're
yeah,
in.
Yeah, so you kind of know what part of the world you're in, mm-hmm. but it is that's a very Panamanian sound, that particular sound with the accordion and the sort of slight shouting singing. So it always makes my feet twitch.
Your trip to Panama was the first of many to Central and Southern America, and I've been dying to ask you about a tree that I saw in Colombia, quite near the wetlands, near mangrove, which actually had sort of little legs to it, and I was told that it was able to move from one spot to another. So if it found a more fertile area, it could even move a few feet. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. Well, there's a palm, which is called the walking palm, which is Iriartia, and they have sort of stilt roots, and they can move, but at a rate that you would probably several generations of us would have to wait to watch these palms move. But palms are not really trees. They're more like giant herbs because they don't have proper wood. And so these palms put out roots from the stem. And if there's better soil on one side, they'll put out a root and not on the other side. So just by the fact of that is they kind of can move along, but the rate is pretty slow.
I was very excited. I'd found the day of the Triffids. You know?
Almost.
But, so Central and South America became a new passion for you, really.
Absolutely. And I've spent much of my career working in Central and South America. I also went and collected for the Missouri Botanical Garden again in Peru after I finished my PhD, and spent time in Ecuador. And I have colleagues in Argentina and in Brazil and Costa Rica. And, you know, I've been to many, many places, but each one of them has their own very special wonderfulness.
I think on one of your trips, you actually found a new type of passion flower. How did that happen?
Well, that was incredible. I mean, passion flowers are the most extraordinary flowers. And we were walking up a river called the Rio Guanche in Panama. So this is a river that comes out into the Caribbean. We were walking up the river and floating in the water, I saw an extraordinary flower. I mean, passion flowers look a little bit like sea anemones. So this looked like a beautiful white sea anemone. And I thought, I've never seen anything like that before. I've never seen a flower like that before. So I thought, okay, it's in the water. It has to have come from upstream. So I got into the river and waded up the river until I got to where I saw the branch that was hanging over, which had this passion flower vine on it, which had loads of white flowers on it. And I am utterly rubbish at climbing trees. I mean, that is really not my strong point. So I found a person with an axe, and he came and chopped the branch off the tree, which fell into the water. We then collected the passion flower, plus the tree, plus all of the other plants that grew on it. And everyone was super annoyed with me because we had to walk back to the car in the dark down the river and cross it several times. But it was pretty exciting. And that was a species which didn't have a scientific name. And we named it Passiflora MacDougalliana. It was a big liana, great big woody plant. And John MacDougall was a friend who was studying the taxonomy of passion flowers. So it was a play on words.
So do any bear your name?
Yes. There's a Passiflora sandrii, and there are various things named nappii, yes. Which people always laugh at. But what's annoying is, so when you name something after someone, if you name something after a man, you have two I's after the name. So it would be nappii. But if it's after a woman, it should be AE, because the whole of scientific naming is based on Latin. And what's really annoying is when people name stuff after you and they put two I's there and they know it's you. It's really annoying.
When you're doing field work, how much is about collecting as many different species as you can to bring back to study? And how much are you focused on looking for new strains of your specialist plants?
It's about species, and it's not so much about strains, because I work with things at the species level. So I don't do varieties of tomatoes or potatoes. So I look for different species. And it's very important for people who collect to have permission from the country in which they're collecting. When I collected in Peru and Panama, I had permission to collect everything. So I collected everything I saw. But I'm much more targeted now. And I go collecting solanums, and I often go with particular things in mind. So I go looking. But if I come across something that's a solanum, I'll collect it.
I think the Portuguese word for exploration, explorasoing, also means exploitation. How conscious are you of the history of sort of plant hunting and the dangers therein?
I think today's botanists are very, very conscious of this. It's really important for us to be conscious of this, because what happened in the past is people from institutions from the global north, from both the United States and in Europe, would go to countries in the tropics and just take and never give back. So it's really important for me to leave collections in the countries where I collect. And in my most recent project in the Amazon, all of the collections which we make, they'll be left in institutions in the Amazon.
We've got some rather beautiful vocal music next. Versa est in luctum by Alonso. Where did you first hear this?
I first heard it and I thought, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. Sometimes music sort of hits you that way. You just think, this is marvelous. And this is a piece of music which is composed for the funeral of Philip II. And you can just hear the passion and love. And it's just, it's one of those pieces of music which just surrounds you with beauty.
It's beautiful. It unfolds, doesn't it, like a plant?
It's absolutely beautiful, like leaves unfolding. I just love that piece of music.
Versa est in luctum by Alonso Lobo, performed by the choir of Clare College, Cambridge, conducted by Graham Ross. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the botanist, Dr. Sandra Knapp. You joined the Natural History Museum in London in 1992. What is your role there, Sandy?
I've been a botanist and I've done various things at the museum in science, but currently I'm the interim director of research, which means I'm responsible for the research that goes on around the museum. I mean, I don't do it. Lots of really talented colleagues do the research. So I just try to help as best I can.
As well as the adventure of field work, you're also surrounded by collections of dried plants. And what are you investigating there?
Well, the work I do is almost like origami in reverse. So what I do is I look at things in the herbarium, which are flat and pressed, and in my mind, I reconstruct them to be three-dimensional objects. So I get specimens on loan from lots and lots of different museums, and then I compare them and I work out what I think the species within that group that I'm working on are. Then I write their description, I look at how they're related to one another, I figure out all the ins and outs of the complicated craziness that's the naming of things, and then write fantastically boring pieces of work called monographs.
The potatoes, tomatoes, aubergines in our diet are all, of course, domesticated versions. Why is it important to study the wild varieties?
Well, the wild species have encountered environmental challenges over millennia. And some of those challenges are the challenges that our today's crops will encounter in their future. So the genetic makeup and the way in which wild species have overcome these environmental challenges, we can learn a lot from them to help our crops, which we've essentially bred to be monomorphic, completely pathetic at doing anything except exactly what we want them to do. So they're very vulnerable. The Irish potato famine is a really good example of how vulnerable our crops can be. Ireland was entirely dependent upon potatoes, which are, of course, vegetatively reproduced. So the entire island was a single clone. And a new disease came in, decimated the crop. Millions of people starved.
So what is your attitude towards genetic engineering?
Well, that's, of course, the $64,000 question. Plant breeding, that as traditionally done, is a form of genetic engineering. We've modified these plants for centuries. Indigenous people modify plants. We select things that have bigger fruits. We cross things and bring genes from wild species into our crops. A really good example is the tomato. There's a wild species of tomato on the Galapagos called Solanum cheesemanii, named for Evelyn Cheeseman, so it has an AE because she's a woman. And it has a mutation, which is called jointless. Because normally tomatoes that you grow in your garden, they have the pedicel of the fruit has a little joint in it. So you get the green bit on the top plus a little bit of stalk with every tomato that you pick. Well, that makes it really hard to mechanically harvest. But this mutation, which does away with that joint, allowed for the mechanical harvesting of tomatoes, which basically created the canned tomato and ketchup industries.
So natural biological mutation is one thing, but human beings engineering it themselves, does that worry you, or do you think it's a good idea where it produces crops where people are hungry?
I think it depends. It's one of those things that's not black and white. I'm not entirely comfortable with putting squid genes into potatoes, for example, but I am entirely comfortable with putting genes from a wild species of potato into a cultivated potato. One of the projects that I've done with people who are eggplant breeders, aubergine breeders in southern Spain, is to cross aubergines with a wild species which is incredibly drought resistant. And they did it by tissue culture. So they created a new plant which has a stronger root system and is able to withstand drought more. Now, of course, sometimes if you do things like that, you can introduce not such great characteristics. And that's one of the issues with plant breeding, is that there's a lot of genetic drag. When you have something that is good, that you want like disease resistance, you often bring things like bitterness or poor yield or, you know, something else with it, which is why genetic engineering and some of this CRISPR-Cas9 engineering, which people are talking about now, is so attractive, because you can take the single thing you want without all this other stuff that comes with it.
That's fascinating. We're going to celebrate a potato next, the Jersey Royal.
Fantastic.
Tell me about this.
Well, this is a piece of music composed by Helen Anahita Wilson, who is an incredibly talented composer. And I met her because about 6 years ago, I had chemotherapy. I had cancer and went through chemotherapy. And one of the things that's extraordinary about chemotherapy is that many of the drugs that are used in chemotherapy are plant-based. They're plant-derived. So really, biodiversity can save your life. So I wrote a blog on the NHM website, on the museum's website, that was called Biodiversity Can Change Your Life. And she had read this blog and she had had a similar experience. And so she contacted me and she said, I would really like to meet you. So we got to be friends. But she's a classically trained pianist. And what she does that I helped her with is she attaches electrodes to plants and then records the frequencies. But rather than using those like a kind of like a DJ might, as sound mixes of those sounds, what she does is she translates those frequencies into instruments in her head and composes pieces of music based on the electrical signals that are coming from these plants.
I shan't think of Jersey Royals again without thinking of that slightly bossa nova sound.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, and I think what's fascinating about the way she does this is that she's translating all of those plant signals into something different. And it's wonderful.
That's the original thing, isn't it? If you just simply took the electrical sounds, which lots of people have done, plants and water, that's one thing. But to then put it back onto instruments so that you reimagine the colours, that's very different.
Yes, one of the tracks on this album is called The Devil's Trumpet, which is about datura, which is the jimson weed, a deadly poisonous plant, which has all kinds of interesting magic connotations. All of the pieces on this album are based on the family Solanaceae, so they're all based on that family that I study. So there's Aubergine Dream, and it's just wonderful.
Jersey Royal from the album Nightshade by Helen Anahita Wilson. The album actually is dedicated to you, isn't it, Sandy?
Yes, it is. I was very touched, actually. It was really kind of her to do
that. The Queen of Selenium. But that's not your only honour. You also have many plants named after you. And important to point out that you don't name new plants after yourself.
No, that's definitely frowned upon.
So are there rules for naming?
There are lots and lots of rules for naming plants. And what's interesting about the International Code of Nomenclature for algae, fungi and plants is that it's I like to think of it as the longest running voluntary code of conduct for any science. Every 6 years there's a meeting to revise the code, and people make proposals to revise the code. And so I chair this meeting of 200 people. And there's a very live debate going on in the sciences, in the science of taxonomy now, about whether eponymy is a good thing or not. because many of the people for whom plants or animals were named, we now no longer think of as being very nice people. So should those names disappear? Should we change those names? And I always feel that if you make something go away and hide it under the carpet, then you never remember the bad either.
Now, we've touched on this next question slightly, but you also did research looking at the gender gap in naming. And what overall did you find?
Well, this is a project which I did with some colleagues of mine, and a lot of us had this sort of idea at the same time. And I had written a book called In the Name of Plants, which is about plant genera that are named for people. And it was really hard to choose. I thought, ooh, it'll be really hard to get enough to make a good book. But actually, I had to cut back huge numbers. And I tried to balance it out. And I realized that actually, in doing that, it's hard to find plants that are named for women. And so with my colleagues, we started a project of looking at all of the flowering plant genera that were named for women. And we decided to do it in quite a special way. We decided to do it by creating Wikidata pages. So not Wikipedia, but Wikidata, which is the thing that underpins Wikipedia. That means their name can then be amplified throughout the rest of the knowledge system, which is the internet. Of all of the genera of flowering plants, of which there's about 16,000, there's only about 800 or 900 which are named for women.
Well, still on the subject of nomenclature, I've been calling you Sandy, but in professional circles you go by Sandra. Is there a reason for that?
Yes. Yeah, there is a reason. Because Sandy is often the nickname for boys who are called Alexander. So to avoid disappointment, I always write my name as Sandra so that when people meet me in the flesh, they aren't disappointed.
Gustav Holst next.
Yes. My children, when they were young, sang in the London Oratory Junior Choir. And this piece was always played at Christmas. And the version we're going to hear is that played when one of my children was singing in the choir. And I've never found another version of Personnant Hodie that's played with the energy that Patrick Russell plays the organ in this version.
Yeah.
Those three repeated chords make it very memorable, don't they?
It's a wonderful piece. And I mean, it's one of those ones that makes your heart sing.
Personent Hodie by Holst, performed by the London Oratory Choir and the Oratory Junior Choir, with Patrick Russell playing the organ. When they weren't busy singing, Sandy, did you ever take your children on your searches for plants?
We did. We took them in the field several times. And one time we went to Ecuador, and I can remember I made them do diaries. You know, I was a kind of, you know, must write in your diary every day. And I can remember my eldest son writing in his diary, drive, 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 drive. All we do is drive. This is so boring. But they, in their later lives, they always said it was an amazing experience going in the field and actually helping us do the work we were doing.
It's the joy of finding a new variety or a new strain somewhat tempered these days with the sadness of losing so many.
Yes, yes, it is. And it's not so much losing species, it's losing habitat. Because one of the greatest causes of extinction is land use change and loss of habitat. And it happens in the desert as well as in the tropical rainforest. And I think one of the things that probably was a horrible experience when I lived in Panama is we had collected in the Darién. They built the road down into the Darién every dry season because it was too wet in the wet season. So they built the road down. So we would drive down there and collect in this extraordinary forest. And going back down a few months later, and it had all been cut down.
Yeah.
All of it. And your heart sank and you thought, oh my goodness. But actually, the Darién is a really good example of how resilient nature is. Because Balboa... So the poem is that Stout Cortez discovered the Pacific Ocean. It was actually Balboa. But Balboa writes about riding through to the mountains where they stood and first saw the Pacific, riding through savannah, which is grassland, in an area which was forest when I was collecting there. So that's not so many years, 400 years. So nature is pretty resilient, although we're doing our best.
Where have you felt the impact of climate change most?
One of the things is fires. Is the kind of incidence of fires. Even in places like New Mexico, where I grew up, the incidence of fire, many, many more fires now than there were when I was growing up.
Of course, up to a point, fire can be regenerative, can't it?
Up to a point. Many, many types of habitats are sort of fire-enabled to a certain extent, is that the fire is needed to release the seeds from the cones or whatever. But it's when the fire gets too hot. So you think of fire as being one temperature, but there can be kind of cool fires and really hot fires. And when there's a lot of fuel loading on the ground, so if a fire hasn't passed through somewhere in a long time, or if there's been a lot of forest cutting and it's very, very dry, then fires can be very, very hot. And then they not only kill all the plants, but they also kill everything in the soil.
It sounds as though deforestation is almost more significant in your work than actual climate change.
They go hand in hand. The loss of biodiversity and climate change absolutely go hand in hand. And that's one of the really important things that came out of the COP summit that was held here in the UK in Glasgow, is that climate change and biodiversity are, you can't think of one without thinking of the other.
You've also been involved in the study of the archaeology of plants. And does that give you some hope that plants are evolving all the time to cope with change, finding ingenious ways to move and to adapt?
Plants do evolve all the time. It's the rate of evolution and the rate of change which we humans are causing on the planet, which is the problem. Is plants can evolve and they can adapt and they can move and they can disperse to different environments. But the rate at which change is happening is almost too much for organisms to bear.
Karine Polwart next, and Rivers Run.
I discovered this when we were building our urban nature project around the Natural History Museum with the group of people who sing spell songs, which Karine Polwart is part of that group. And I got very interested in their music and found this. And I love this piece of music. But the thing that really brings it home for me is one of the important pieces of music for me, is it was also played at the funeral of one of my very, very great colleagues, Richard Forty, who was a trilobite expert. And I was asked to speak at his funeral. And when I saw on the order of service that they were playing Rivers Run, I thought, this is perfect.
This weary earth we walk upon, she will endure when we are gone. While kingdoms come and kingdoms go, rivers run and rivers flow. You know I don't believe it's true that in this world there's nothing new. For darling, you have just begun. Rivers flow and rivers run. And if the river should ever run dry, somewhere the rain will still fall from the sky. When I'm beguiled by the fear, the darker days are drawing near. My darling, you seduce the sun. Rivers flow and rivers run. And if the river should ever run dry, somewhere the rain will still fall. This wounded earth we walk upon, she will endure when we're gone. But still I pray that you may know how rivers run and rivers flow. And if the river should ever run dry, somewhere the rain will still fall. Will still fall. Across my heart, and I hope to live just long enough that I can give it all to you, my darling one. Rivers flow and rivers run, my darling one. Rivers flow and rivers run.
Rivers Run by Karen Polwart. You spent, Sandy Knapp, part of the autumn last year in the Amazon rainforest. Is that still a thrill for you to go there?
Oh, absolutely. I am completely thrilled every time I go in the field. I love the forest. I mean, it's very hot. It's very hot. It's very sweaty. It's very hard walking up hills and mountains, and there are a lot of insects. But golly, it's just the sheer diversity and the amazingness. And it kind of reminds you that nature is incredibly powerful. Mm. And we are only a bit player in the history of life on Earth.
Now, while you were there, you recorded some sounds.
Yeah, and those sounds I recorded at dusk. So that was right when the sun was setting, and the acoustics above the canopy and the acoustics in the forest are so different. Yeah, it's always fascinating.
Well, let's hear first Under the Canopy and see if that transports you back and what you remember from it. Here we are. Remember that?
Oh, yes. It's wonderful. I mean, the noise is incredible. You feel as though you're in an enclosed space, and you can hear the birds up above a little bit, but it's mostly frogs and insects. So when you sleep in your hammock, that's the noise in the night.
Well, let's move up above the canopy now.
We climbed to the top of a tower, and we looked out over the forest. And in a way, the tropical rainforest from above looks like broccoli. You know, it's kind of... the trees all fit beautifully together. Those are toucanets duetting. They call to one another in a sort of duet, almost like the duet from flutes from Cardillac. You get that duetting of the toucanets. It was wonderful to hear.
I love hearing the natural sounds of nature. It's a music in itself, isn't
it? Oh, it's a complete music in and of itself. And just sitting and listening, and it's gorgeous.
As you get older, I mean, you'll be 70 this year, do you plan to do less travelling or more?
I plan to keep travelling until I can no longer travel.
Hmm. Are you already planning your next field trip?
Absolutely, because part of planning field work is getting the permission to go where you want to go. And the next place in the Amazon that I intend to go is north of Manaus, north of where we were before, all the way up the Rio Vaupés to near the Colombian border. But I'm very much looking forward to going and working with the local communities in this particular area. It's apparently 3 days boat ride from the last town, and I'm going to leave everything I collect in Brazil.
We've come to the end of our trip, I'm afraid. So what is our final piece?
Our final piece takes me back to my playing the viola. And I can remember again the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival when I was a child. And one of the things that we always wanted to go and see was Itzhak Perlman and Pinchas Zukerman. And I was always completely struck with the fact that Pinchas Zukerman made the viola, again, like Steve Tenenbaum, just absolutely sing. Because there aren't that many pieces written for a viola. It's often thought to be that thing that kind of sits in the background, but in and of itself, it's a beautiful instrument.
So it only remains for me to say thank you very much for this trip through the canopies and your world, wonderful world of botany.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's been wonderful listening to all these pieces of music again.
Brahms's Sonata for Viola No. 2 in E flat, the third movement, Andante con moto, played by Pinchas Zukerman with Daniel Barenboim at the piano. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the botanist Sandra Knapp. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman. And next week, Michael's guest will be Richard Stokes, a leading expert on German lieder or art songs. Now, Schoenberg is the destination in Music Map. That's after we look ahead.
20th Century Radicals, Radio 3's landmark series exploring the pivotal musical works of the 20th century.
Over the course of this series, there are a few names that keep on cropping up. Figures whose influence sent tremors across the musical world. John Cage, Pierre Boulez, and also Olivier Messiaen.
On our next episode, join Gillian Moore as she explores colour, ecstasy and birdsong in the radical music of Messiaen. 20th Century Radicals continues tonight from 9 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Now it's time to join Sarah Moore-Peach as she explores the connection between music and poetry in one of the most famous early works by Arnold Schoenberg.
Hello, I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we take a single piece of classical music and plot a course towards it, making connections as we go. Today, we're being drawn back in time to the city of Vienna at the turn of the 20th century. This is Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night, by Arnold Schoenberg, his most important early work, which he wrote for string sextet in 1899 and which was premiered 3 years later, then reworked for string orchestra. But it's the original sextet version we're going to hear today. So let's start with a couple of other string sextets, beginning in Renaissance England. The suitably woody, melancholic sound of six viols. Jordi Savall and Hesperian 21 there playing an In Nomine by Henry Purcell. It's a much denser texture than the one that ended up evolving into the common string quartet.